Zach loved God. Zach loved coming to church. More accurately, he loved the sermons, he loved singing, he loved prayer time, he loved the fact that his wife and kids enjoyed being there, but inwardly he was struggling. He was struggling to love the people around him, to love those who were his church family. I mean, why were they so selfish? Why did they arrive so late? And when they did, they made so much noise. And why did not more people help? Why was it always left to the same few to do all the jobs? What was he, a counselor, a pastor, an elder? No. And yet over coffee, people just moaned and grumbled on, moaning and grumbling about the silliest things. And it wasn't just the people at church that Zach struggled to love. I mean, there was his wider family, his parents, his siblings. Boy, did they seem to wind him up. And then there were his neighbours. We won't go there. And his work colleagues, they never got it right. No one could please him. He loved God, he said, but he could do without the people God made, apart from a few maybe. And yet it's clear, isn't it? You can't love God and not his people. The last time we were in Exodus, we looked at the first four commandments, loving God with all of our hearts, souls, and minds. And let's be honest, in many ways, it feels much easier to love God than to love others. But Jesus, having stated the first great command is to love God, goes on to say, the second is love your neighbor as yourself. And he summarizes these last six commandments. We saw last time why these Ten Commandments are still relevant to us. We recognized there were differences. We're no longer under the Old Covenant, the Old Testament law. But 2 Timothy 3:16, all Scripture is God-breathed and useful for teaching, rebuking, correcting, and training in righteousness. And there was something fundamental about the nature of these 10 words. And as such, they still apply to us, particularly as Jesus picks them up and applies them to us in much of the New Testament. But it is not just to be obeyed outwardly in conformity, but inwardly as well, in our hearts. But we're not to obey them to earn our salvation, to make us his people. Like them, God saved them first and made them his people before he gave them his commands. Exodus 20, verses 1 to 2. Similar with us, he saves us and then teaches us how to live. The big difference between us and them is that they had to obey all of the commands in order to keep the covenant, in order to remain in it. Whereas Jesus does that for us. Jesus has fully kept the covenant by his life and his death. He kept all the requirements of the law. And for those who trust in him, he clothes us in his perfect obedience, clothes himself in our disobedience, and he then takes the punishment, the penalty, the curses of the cross, of the law for our disobedience on the cross, so that we might stand before God as those who are forgiven and right and perfect. So the first question this morning, is that you? Are you forgiven? Do you know you are right before God? And if that is you, we now obey these Ten Commandments from the law, not as keepers of the law to keep it, but as those who are fulfillers, as those who the law has been kept for, who remain in Jesus, safe in Jesus, who cannot be removed in Jesus because he has obeyed and that never changes. And so we now live as those who reflect him, as those who are fulfillers, as it were, as those who have kept the law. How do we do that? Paul writes Romans 13:10, love is the fulfillment of the law. Paul then quotes the last six commands. He says, whatever other command there may be, and they're summed up in this one command, love your neighbor as yourselves. We are to love others. And we're to love others in that we follow Jesus' example, who obeyed his Father, loving others, loving those who were his enemy, loving those made in God's image, and we're to do the same. Jesus says, if you love me, you'll obey my commands. This call to love flows from grace, from the grace given to us at the cross, but grace experienced is always expressed in obedience. And God in his grace spells out exactly what that looks like, what it is to love others. We saw how it is to love God, how it is to love others by these six commands. But remember, all of us, to some degree, have broken each of these commands. So we'll all need to repent. But if we're trusted in Jesus, he's forgiven us and accepted us so that we can hear as his people how we are to live, even if we don't always perfectly match up to it. His grace extends to us. It covers us, including past sin, present sin, and further sin, that we might be those who love others like Jesus. So with that said, those who love God will love others like Jesus did. Loving others like Jesus did will mean obeying God's commands. Firstly then, love honours parents. Verses 12. Now it's striking that when Jesus summarises these commands, he says, love your neighbour as yourself. Who is my neighbour? Well, we see immediately it starts with those closest to us, family, and then works out. And so we're to honour our parents. What does that look like? Well, initially it means obeying parental authority. Obeying parental authority is the beginning of respecting authority in general. If children don't learn to respect authority in the home, then society will be chaotic. Even more significantly, they reject the authority of our Heavenly Father. See, in part, why is this command placed here? Because it's a transitional verse. See, the first four commands are all to do with loving God. Where's that learnt? In the home. The last five commands are all to do with loving others, respecting others. Where's that learnt? In the home. It begins with honouring parents, obeying them. In doing so, I demonstrate love for them. So for those of us who are parents, how are we instructing our children in such a way that they are honouring us, learning obedience, that they might obey God, and in turn respect authority in society and love others? As we get older, we're still called to honour our parents, and I think by implication, if we're married, our in-laws, but now not in obedience like when I was a child. I am not under their authority in the same way. It's particularly if I'm married, I'm a new family. Therefore, I am not under their control. I don't have to do everything they say when they say it. I think much of marital tension happens because we get this wrong. We think honouring them as we get older means I have to do everything they say when they say it. That's not the case, I don't think. We are a new family by that stage, particularly if we're married. But to honour them must mean I value their opinion. I respect them in how I speak of them. I'm not belittling them or demeaning them or mocking them. I'm caring for them in their old age. And what that looks like will vary depending on family, but it needs to be worked out. So it might mean caring for them by visiting. It might mean providing practical care and financial help. It might mean working out accommodation for them as they get frailer. But I'm seeking to show my love for them and to honour them in my care of them. I know for some of you, your parents were not great. Maybe they were abusive. Maybe they neglected you. Are we still to honour such ones? I think the answer is yes, with the Lord's help. What does that look like? Well, it doesn't mean we just ignored what happened. Or if necessary, we report such actions to the required authorities, the police. We're not saying honouring means keeping quiet. Absolutely not. It means we forgive. We seek reconciliation if that is possible. At the very least, Jesus would say we must have an attitude of forgiveness, a willingness to forgive them if it was possible towards them. I think it means we're always careful how we speak of them in such situations. So we speak of facts, but we mustn't belittle or slander. And of course, the truth is, honouring ageing parents can be hard for many of us in different ways. My sinful nature means I'm selfish, loving myself more than I love my neighbour. I become consumed by my own life, my own work, and my own family, and so I neglect this responsibility, particularly if they're not local, out of sight, out of mind. It's been a great challenge to me over the past year or two. And yet honouring parents is so important that it's the only command that has a promise attached. That those who honour their parents will live long in the land the Lord your God has given you. For the Israelites, failure to honour parents, breaking this command, would lead to the curse of exile. This command was equated with idolatry, because the relationship between parent and child is, after marriage, the most powerful illustration of the loving relationship between God and his people. So significant is this that Paul expresses it in Ephesians 6. So we read, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, so that it may go well with you and that you may enjoy long life on earth." Note, Paul drops the Old Testament reference to life in the promised land, because Paul now understands that God's already kept his promise of life in the earthly kingdom, earthly land, to Israel. But for the believer, honoring our parents is part of our allegiance to Christ and will be rewarded by God, partly in the coming, well, totally in the coming of the kingdom of heaven, and to some degree in the fullness of life now, although it's qualified by our own sin and living in a fallen world. Because it's not always the case that you honour your parents and have long life. The world's fallen, it's broken, and none of us do it perfectly. And of course, Jesus is the perfect example of one who honoured his father perfectly. He says, "I do exactly what my father has commanded me to do." But he did not endure a long life here. But what is being offered is, the normal way God works is like this. You honour your parents, there is long life. And I think it's because we learn how to live rightly before God and others, and it brings blessing. So significant is this command. The promise is attached both in the Old Testament and the New Testament. So how are you beginning to love others? Are you honouring your parents? Are you teaching your children to honour your parents? To honour you. Loving others will mean honouring parents. Loving others like Christ will mean love does not murder. Verse 13. Literally, putting to death someone improperly for selfish reasons rather than with authorization. So this command doesn't rule out capital punishment or war. God's old covenant people were delegated the right to take human life by his command. But no Israelite on his own had the right to take life, because we're made in God's image. Only God has the authority to give and take life. Genesis 9 verse 6. Reads, "Whoever sheds human blood, by humans shall their blood be shed, for in the image of God has God made mankind." That's still true today. And God delegates the right of capital punishment and war to the state. Just as he did to Israel, he does to the state now, Romans 13. But nothing else, because life is precious, as those made in his image. And yet sinfully and selfishly, governments have gone beyond what God has allowed. So they've deemed euthanasia, I have the right to give my life when life gets really hard, a right. Or abortion, a mother has the right to kill her unborn child for her own benefit. But neither is an option for God's people. For both euthanasia and abortion would fall under this command to not murder, to not take life for selfish reasons. We're made in the image of God. From the moment we're conceived, and even when our bodies are ravaged by disease. Now, Jesus takes this command and shows God's will is not just mere outward conformity, but the very attitude of my heart. That actually I can murder people in my heart. So Matthew 5:22, anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. And Jesus parallels that with those who murder. And that is because anger is the seed form of murder. That is, if you get angry and you allow that anger to continue, don't check it, you just continue in rage and upset, and you continue down that path, as it were, that trajectory, it will end in murder. That's the trajectory. Now, it's unlikely any of us, I hope, will literally kill someone. But in our anger, Jesus says, we are displaying the same desires and motives as those who do. They all arise from the same heartful. Why do we get angry? James 4 verse 1 says, because we desire and covet something. So when someone withholds something from us, whether it be literally something they have, or they don't agree with me and they withhold their approval or affirmation, and I get angry. And in some, that anger leads to literal murder. But if you have ever harbored violent thoughts or plotted or imagined another downfall or ranted at someone or torn a strip of someone with your words, even if you've just thought it, you've not actually expressed it, Jesus says you've murdered. You've killed them, as it were, to get your way. Just because you've not done so literally, that seed is in your heart. That is what you're seeking. That is what you're wanting. What drives that is our own selfish desires, our own wants, needs, freedom to be in control. And yet Jesus, even as his enemies nailed him to the cross, Christ's heart was not filled with hatred. He wasn't concerned with his own life or his own freedom. He prayed, Father, forgive. He didn't take life. His plans were dominated by his desire to give life in order to give others life. To love our neighbor as ourselves. Well, I mean, we're not driven by demanding. Making sure our desires and needs are met. So not murdering people either literally or in our hearts to get my way. See, rather I'd be concerned about others' needs and others' desires and to put them first. And entrusting ourselves and our needs instead, like Jesus, to our Heavenly Father's care as his people, as his child. See, loving others will mean I won't murder. Loving others will mean not committing adultery, verse 14. Love does not commit adultery. No one is allowed to have sex with any married person except their spouse. Marriage is foundational to the creation order, to human society. It's the bedrock. Husbands and wives can hardly function fully as one flesh if they do not trust each other. At the end of the day, we're all connected to family. So you start undermining those, breaking the trust, breaking them up, you're going to have an impact on society. You're going to fragment it. And it's not loving your neighbor if you leave your spouse to have sex with someone else. You're not loving your immediate neighbor, wife, husband, children, nor are you loving others' families that are involved, and nor are you loving the wider society. It's the complete inverse of loving others. In fact, it boils down to loving oneself, driven by one's own desires and own needs. So seriously, does God see this, that those who broke it under the Old Testament law were stoned to death? Because God saw the harm that would be caused, the lack of love that was expressed, and the covenants that are broken. Now again, Jesus takes this beyond mere outward conformity. And says, actually, anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Matthew 5:28. Again, If you allow lustful thoughts to fester, you travel down the path, and where you will end is in physical adultery. Thinking of it, acting on it, arise from the same desires. Now, similarly to murder, on one level, to actually commit adultery physically is worse than just in our hearts. But Jesus says, at another level, it's the same. Same desires, same motives. So have you ever harbored lustful thoughts? Ever looked at someone who's not your spouse and imagined what sex with them might look like? Not a weird, fleeting thought, but found yourself continually thinking about and fantasizing being with them. Or imagined them as your spouse, or looked far too long at a lady or a man. Yet Jesus, John 13 verse 1 says, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. Jesus gave himself for his bride. Jesus is more concerned to lay down his life for his bride, even though at times we do not love him as we ought. He remains faithful, other-centered, more concerned for their well-being than his. And as God's people, ought our marriages not be marked by that faithfulness? See, not just in outward conformity, but inward heart desire that's more concerned with nurturing and caring for and laying down my life for my spouse and loving my closest neighbor as ourselves than running or daydreaming or lingering in looks elsewhere. Because people are reflective of their God, his faithfulness, laying down our lives, loving others more than ourselves. See, loving others will mean not committing adultery. But loving others will mean love does not steal. Verse 50. Stealing is taking something that does not belong to you without permission. Again, stealing threatens the social order. It causes pain to others. You're not loving your neighbor if you're stealing from them. Remember, Jesus teaches it's our hearts matter as much as in our hands, and stealing starts in the heart. It arises from either a lack of trust for God to provide, Matthew 6, or a lazy heart, Ephesians 4. That is, I don't want to work that hard, so I will steal literally stuff to get what I need rather than work. Or I might have be a lazy heart will steal from my employer by not doing the work I'm paid to or not working as hard as I can, instead surfing the internet. Or stealing can arise from an entitled heart. I work so hard for my employer. As such, I'm entitled to more than what my company pays me. So I deserve a little me time each day. So I'll take a little me time during the day, a little Facebook, Twitter, Tinderbox time. I deserve it. What I'm doing, though, is stealing time. Or I'll think to myself, you know what, I'll pay myself extra by taking stuff. Who's going to miss that nice pucker A4 pad or pen? My kids will be happy. But in love, Jesus came to give, not to take. The thief comes to the sheep only to steal and kill and destroy. Jesus says, I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. No one takes my life from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. Jesus gives to the point of giving his life. If he will give me his life, will he not provide all I need? I'm to trust him. As such, I don't need to steal from my neighbors. Or in my workplace, I'm not to be lazy or feel entitled, but rather to give like Christ. I'm to be a giver, not a stealer. See, what will that look like? Will it mean working hard? Will it mean producing quality work? To be one who is quick to think of others, to serve others on the team, to go the extra mile, to support the team and the client and the customer? But it will be outside of that, won't it? Think about how to give my life to others, to my neighbors and to my friends and to my friends at the school gate. Not stealing from them, maybe with my time. not to be lazy, and to serve others, and to give to others, not demanding what I think I'm entitled to or being lazy. We're givers, not stealers. Loving others will mean love does not give false testimony. Verse 16. And in part this has the law court scene in view. You're speaking truthfully about others and what they have done. Particularly in that courtroom scene, that was the idea in Israel, that as they heard things, but many of us probably won't be in a courtroom, but all of us speak of events that have happened, either directly to us or that we have witnessed. We're involved in an argument, we overhear an argument, and we never just give facts, we then seek to interpret those facts, and in interpreting them, we so often give false testimony. Because what I do is I impute motive or reasons for someone's behavior that they've not expressed, and I cast them in a particular light. So someone says something or does something to me, and I think it's because they don't love me or like me or wish to harm me. Whereas it's none of those things. Or I witness someone do something or buy something, and I think they're doing it for completely different reasons. Because they're greedy or judgmental or idolatrous. You know, you see it each week, don't you? You see little ways it works out. Someone arrives late at church. And in our hearts, maybe we're thinking, oh, they're lazy. They need to get better organized. Whereas actually, it may just be that they've been loving their family well and had to drop their mother off at their church around the corner, which starts just before ours did, and it took a little bit longer to settle her in this week because of her particular needs, and then they've rushed round to get here to this church. But we've sat there and thought, lazy. Or we've just seen someone buy something new, and we think greedy. Or we judge what their condition of their finances. You see, we give false testimony. We're imputing motive and reason onto that person that we actually don't know. And the way we give that false testimony is in two ways. We either give it to our own hearts. We're very good at that, aren't we? We churn over all the reasons why these people have done this to us or what we've observed them doing. And what we do is we condemn them to the judge of our hearts, our inward judge. And we write them off. We give false testimony to them. Or we gossip. That's why gossip is so dangerous, because often in our gossip we can slander someone or infer something about them that's actually just not true. We impute a wrong motive or a reasoning to their action. You see, we're giving false testimony about them. Now, of course, false testimony has a wider implication as well. Lies, we're not to speak untruthfully, we're not to lie, and so often the reason we do is to protect ourselves and protect our reputation and protect our feelings rather than love someone else. I'm not loving my neighbor when I do those things. Jesus says, I do nothing on my own but speak just what the Father has taught me. Indeed, Jesus is the truth. There's nothing false about him. And lies and falsehood are marks of the devil. They're not of Jesus. His people are to be known as those who speak truth. Truth in love, Ephesians 4. Truth that helps and builds up and that equips, that moves someone closer to Christ, that protects their reputation, that honors them. That's really loving someone, isn't it? And yet so often we fear to speak the truth to people. We'd rather lie or deceive or impute because we don't want to harm their feelings or we want to be liked. But love is more concerned for the greater well-being than any initial sting our words may say. To love my neighbour well is to speak truth about them and to them. It's seek to understand them and to know their motive, not just assume their motives. And finally, love doesn't covet. Verse 17, it's not envious, it's not jealous, it's not bitter, because you have that and I don't. Have you ever wished your life was different? Ever wished that someone else didn't have something because you don't have it, and you dislike them because they do, or you've grown bitter with God because he chose to give a blessing to someone else and not you? It's not love. Love rejoices with those who rejoice. Love celebrates. hearts. We know that in our own families, when someone does well, we rejoice, we celebrate. We're not envious of them because we love them. When we find our hearts bitter and envious and always wishful, love is lacking. It's either lacking in love for others or it's lacking in love for God. Because there's a sense that what I'm saying is, God, you're not enough. What you've given me is not enough, and you've got this wrong. And yet Jesus is content with God's will, even when that meant the cross. He said, now my soul is troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour? No, it's for this very reason I came to this hour. He had a right to more riches and influence and praise than any other human, and yet instead he freely, joyfully chose to become poor for our good and his Father's glory and to give us his people every blessing. We're not to covet what others have. But the one thing I can covet is Jesus. To be more like him. To love others greater. To be more Christ-like. Because in him I have all I need. Every treasure and blessing. All of eternity. And knowing this and holding to this frees me to love others well. To rejoice with them. To celebrate with them. Even if I don't have what they have materially. I have all I need in Jesus. Six little words, six little commands, that obedience to will give me greater freedom to love others well. See, imagine a world where all these commands are perfectly kept, and we all loved each other as we love ourselves, perfectly loving like Christ. Would not the world be a better place? And where you begin to see these inactions, these little glimpses, you know something is different. You know Jesus is at work. Because this is how we're called to live as God's people. This is how one day we will live perfectly. Till that day, I will break these commands and I will not love perfectly. And I will get it wrong. But I am forgiven. If I look to Jesus and I have Christ's Spirit that enables me to begin to love my neighbor as myself, as God has commanded. Is that you this morning? Are you looking to Christ to help you love others well? And when you mess up, are you looking to Christ to forgive you and sustain you? We're called to love God and love our neighbors as ourselves.